This is episode number 783 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Plastic City Comic Con, the Transformers box office somewhat bust, and Iron Maiden getting a new comic. Our comics this week will be Jonah Hex Yosemite Sam number 1, Ash versus Army of Darkness number 1, and Batman number 25. Our summer reading project this week continues with more case files from Judge Dredd, and this week's creator spotlight is our good friend Alana Abbott, as well as the owner of Foxtrot Games, Randy Hoyt. They came on to talk with me about a new game that they've been working on called The Fox in the Forest.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
God, clean the whole fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here as always with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well and soon to be the very well rested.
I am very jealous of you right now because at this point in time, we are at the end of June.
Yes.
I don't have a vacation planned for the summer. I know that we are planning on taking a trip at some point, maybe in August. But I don't have I'm not even off the day before 4th of July.
Wow.
I'm working and I'm one of the only people in the office on Monday. So I don't even have a 3-day weekend thing coming up.
Yep.
You've got a 3-week thing coming up.
Yeah, 3 weeks. So working at Amazon, our building's been completely redone and we are supposed to be opening up on July 13th. But in order to get that, they have to shut the building down and have nobody in it because we were still trying to work around the construction. And that's a tough thing to do.
Sure.
Especially for them. We're worried about getting killed by their machinery.
They just want you out of the way.
And they're worried about crushing us.
They're like, this guy in the KISS t-shirt is walking around pointing at us. Get out of here.
Yeah, get out of here. So they came up with a plan that said, we're going to shut down the building. And first I'm like, oh, crap, 2 weeks without pay. That's not going to work.
That's going to be rough.
Well. And then it ended up being, to me, for my schedule-wise, I almost have 3 full weeks off with pay.
Yep.
So I'm very excited. Very rested, very ready
I would to go. Be excited as well. I'm just very jealous and bitter right now.
I have not had a good vacation in probably 3 years. So this is one of the first times.
Right, since you started working there, basically,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Has it been 3 years now?
It's been 2 years there. But before that, I had a couple years where I didn't quite take the week vacations because it was hard because of the job. And
yep.
Blah, 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 blah.
But now, is it going to be a staycation?
Staycation.
That's my favorite.
And the best part is the family's going to be going away for 3-4 of those days.
That to me is like paradise.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love my family, but
you know what? A little alone time is so important, and that's awesome.
I like waking up, and the only sound in the house I hear is the filter for the pool outside.
Yep.
That is a beautiful thing. So the bedroom's right near it.
Yeah.
So waking up and not hearing anything else, just fabulous.
And then you have that moment of panic like, oh, my gosh, today I have to. Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Do nothing.
That was my day today. I woke up and looked at the clock and went, 9:30.
So I expect you to get caught up on all the season finales of the shows that we haven't talked about yet.
Absolutely.
You might want to mark on your calendar July 7th because that is my birthday, but it is also the day that Spider-Man Homecoming comes out.
So that is your gift. If you haven't already gotten tickets.
Oh, I haven't gotten tickets.
Your tickets will be taken care of.
And my plan is to go to the very first showing on that Friday in Enfield.
Yes.
That's the plan.
So we will be doing that.
I know I'm dragging the kids with me. I am going to hope that my wife will join us on the birthday, but please, by all means, if your wife is around, invite your wife. Let's go enjoy Spider-Man. I have heard awesome things.
I cannot wait.
So far, the early reviews have started coming out. Very excited.
I'm excited.
Very excited. I've been tempering it because I don't want to get – that's my guy.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get too much. I don't want to get too excited for it and then have it be a letdown.
You don't want to pull a Jonah Hex.
Jonah Hex. Oh, wow. That brings a smile to my face every time I think about it.
Yep.
I will never forget that movie.
There is nothing like sitting in the theater.
How have we not done a Saturday matinee?
I know.
Did we never revisit that movie?
We never did. We always talk about doing it. We need to do it.
You know what? While you're on vacation,
yeah,
at least one episode, we're going to come back and do it. We'll do a Jonah Hex Saturday matinee. So anybody who's listening out there, if you haven't seen Jonah Hex yet, watch it. If you have seen it, you're going to have to watch it again.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about it.
My favorite moment in that entire movie was every time something embarrassing or bad would happen, it was you and Aaron Wood and somebody else I thought went with us. But every time something bad and embarrassing happened, everybody looked at me like, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? Your favorite character of all time.
To me, that was when I went to see, like, I'll never forget when I went to see the Dungeons and Dragons movie when that came out, because that was the first one.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. Like, this was after the first Hobbit, I believe.
Yeah.
Or the first Lord of the Rings movie. So I'm thinking, like, this is D&D. I've been waiting my entire life for this movie to come on the big screen. And it was horrendous.
Yes.
And I just remember sitting there trying to hold on to anything from that movie that was remotely okay or felt like actual, like, D&D, the game that I grew up with, and there was so little.
Yeah.
And it was brutal.
I remember when the movie ended and we all kind of looked at each other, and my only comment I had was, wow, Megan Fox really did a great job in this movie.
She was the highlight.
She was like the shining moment in that movie.
And what's Magneto? Magneto.
Michael Fassbender.
Thank you. You came up with that name. I couldn't get it. It wasn't there for me. He actually played a decent villain.
That's right. It was him.
Yeah.
Huh. John Malkovich.
But again, I'll say again, the movie's fascinating because never have I seen such a chopped up movie on screen and wondered what the heck happened behind the scenes. And we still to this day have not gotten like the definitive director's cut.
I have the Blu-ray.
Yep.
And the Blu-ray is basically what I saw on the screen, clearer.
I just want it. I want to know exactly what happened. I mean, the recycled footage of him riding a horse in a big screen movie like that, like,
yep.
Amazing.
With that kaleidoscope of colors.
Oh, so good. With the different filters thrown over it. So, yeah. So amazing. So amazing. Yes, we must revisit that movie. Okay. So before, and that's not even the news yet, Matt.
No.
Before we jump into the news, though. Yeah. And not to start on a down note, but we did mention in the last episode of the show that Tommy Castillo, mm-hmm. an artist that we have known for years, who we saw at many shows in the New York area, who had health issues for a very long time, was in rough shape. His wife, Samantha, had posted a video on Facebook kind of giving an update about his condition, and it was not a good update. From the time that we recorded that show until just a couple days later, he passed away.
Yeah.
And from the first update, it didn't seem like it was that imminent. It seemed like he could still be with us for a while, and this could he could be at home for a while, but it seems to have gone very quickly. So he did pass away, and that is just super sad. If you have not been over to the Facebook page for Tommy Castillo, what is very nice and very touching is that the page is still up,
yeah.
And people are leaving tribute messages. People are going and leaving the stories of when they met him at a show, or, you know, they commissioned some work from him, or, you know, he looked at their artwork or something like, yeah. That. Like, so many like awesome stories of people saying, you know, 10 years ago I met this guy, or 5 years ago I met this guy, and he was such a great guy. And for his wife to be able to see how many people's lives, mm-hmm. he had a positive impact on, I think is really important as she kind of heals and goes through this.
Yeah.
And so I would encourage you to go over. It is sad, and you can certainly see some of the updates that she's left, which are absolutely heartbreaking. And I said last week, and I'll say it again, she is like a superhero.
Yeah.
Like, the courage that she has shown, and the just her willingness to stay connected to the comic book community and keep them updated about what's going on with Tommy, and have to deliver these just gut-wrenching messages with everything that she's going through, has just been nothing short of amazing. So go support her. Go celebrate Tommy Castillo. Go, tell your stories if you've met him before. And his artwork is going to live forever.
Yeah.
His legacy is going to live forever. But for a guy that was in his mid-40s, man, way, way too soon, yep. for us to lose him.
I remember when we saw the video, we talked about it, and I remember just – I knew how much he was suffering from all this, and I remember just praying that it would be quick. because nobody should suffer like this. It's a tough, tough, tough situation. And I was very relieved when I heard the news because the entire there was no good end game in this. The end game was going to
be the prognosis was not going was not that he was going to get better.
Yeah,
right.
And I've seen family members go through things like this, and it's awful. It is the worst thing. And I posted a picture up on my Facebook page and put it on theirs of him and Becky when Becky was about six sitting together. And when I found that picture, I went through some other things. I cannot believe how many Tommy Castile sketches we have. If they were money, we'd be rich.
Yep.
It was, and I was going to say something, but knowing him made us rich enough, but that was stupid and corny. But it was really interesting because I remember he did a nice big charcoal drawing of Catwoman for Becky.
Uh-huh.
And we went to a show. We saw him. He's like, "Hey, I was thinking about you a couple of days ago. Knew I was going to see you at the show. And, you know, I was trying to my new charcoals, and here's this." And it was to Becky. And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" What a great guy. He was like that with a lot of people. But
just immensely talented.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of forgot about the fact he came over here and had dinner. He had dinner over here one time, and it was – I didn't remember that until I found out he passed away. I mean, I'm thinking he sat in my dining room. He was in my house. He came to my comics.
And I talk about this all the time, but it's one of those things where you just take for granted that – people you know and things you know are just going to be there.
Yeah.
Just that you don't even think about it. You know what I mean? We'd think about how many times we saw him at a show and we didn't have time to talk or he didn't have time to talk and it was just like a wave.
Yeah.
You know, like, "Hey, how's it going? Hope everything's going good."
Yeah.
You know, and thinking, "We'll run into him next time."
Yeah.
"We'll see him at the next show."
Yep.
And it's just, it's amazing. Truly a great loss. And in an era where maybe art and creativity is not valued as much as it should be, it's a real shame to lose somebody who was so young and still had so much more left to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's but again, that goes back to the whole thing of like, if you like somebody's music, if you like somebody's artwork, if you like somebody's writing, if someone makes something that has an impact on you, tell them.
Yeah.
Because we won't get to tell Tommy that again. And that is super sad.
Yeah.
And if you've never experienced his work, then I again would encourage you to dig into it because that lives on.
Yeah.
So if you didn't know Tommy and you'd never met Tommy and maybe you weren't familiar with his work, go read the stuff that he did for Batman. Go read the Toe Tag series that he did with George Romero.
His run in Detective Comics was
the Evil
great.
Ernie stuff. Like Evil go Ernie. Go and read that stuff and check it out and see why people were blown away by his talent, you know? And it's a shame if you never got a chance to meet him because he was a super nice guy.
Yep.
So man, I feel like we do a lot of these on the new segment of this show. Speaking of shows, Matthew, on to brighter news.
Yes.
We have some shows coming up this summer.
We've got several.
We have Plastic City Comic Con. Now that as people listen to this, we will be in the month of July.
Yeah, it's at the end of it.
On July 29, 2017, at the Wallace Civic Center in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, from 10 to 6, we will be at Plastic City Comic Con. You know who else will be there? Jerry Ordway, Joe Caramagna, Sean Wong, Chris Gugliotti, Jay May, Kat Cusio, George O'Connor, HB Comics, and many more, Matthew.
It's all of our friends.
Yes. This is like, it's like we get to have a high school reunion every summer.
That's exactly the way we put it.
It's like our daily, it's like our one day summer camp.
Keith told me the layout. It's going to be in the hockey arena.
Yep.
So we are all on the floor at the arena.
We might have to wear hockey jerseys for that, Matthew.
I'm doing it.
Might have to do that. Kids 12 and under, free.
Perfect.
As in, doesn't cost you a dime to get in. Adults, $2.
Yeah. Where are you going to get anything for $2?
So basically, for $4, mom and dad can take the whole family to this thing. It's a no-brainer.
And get out of the heat.
And if anybody who experienced last year's show, you know, if you ran into anybody that went there last year, they will tell you.
Yep.
It was a blast. It's a show that celebrates comics. It was nothing but a super fantastic time. So I can't wait to see all of our friends. And then as if we weren't going to see a lot of friends at Plastic City Comic Con, in August, from the 18th to the 20th at the Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut, Terrificon.
And that is another amazing show. For 3 years, this will be the third year under the Terrificon banner.
Yep.
And every year it has just gotten better and better.
Let me just read a few of the guests that are going to be there, Matthew,
this
because
is
this
insane.
List is not comprehensive.
No.
Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, Kurt Busiek, Stan Sakai, Peter David, Chris Giarrusso, and many more.
Yes.
That's on the comic book side. On the entertainment side, Dean Cain, Finn Jones, who played Iron Fist in the most recent Marvel series, Echo Kellum, who plays Mr. Terrific on Arrow, Violet Bean, who plays Jesse Quick on Flash, and Shannon Purser, who played Barb in Stranger Things and plays Ethel,
oh, that's right, Ethel
in Riverdale.
On Riverdale.
That, and that's just a smattering
yeah.
of the people that are going to be at the show. Never mind the weekend full of panels
yep.
that are going to be themed around some of the creations that the comic guests worked on together. And I don't know if those have been announced yet, so I don't want to reveal those yet. But what I love about what Mitch does with Terrificon every year is he brings in creators that have worked on projects together so that we can do panels about those projects.
Yeah.
And like last year, I was fortunate enough to do a panel with Peter David and J.M. DeMatteis and Roger Stern and Dan Slott about Spider-Man.
And that was an awesome
dream
panel.
Come true.
I never go to panels. I had a blast at that one.
You got to do a Captain America panel.
And a Flash one.
And a Flash panel. And so to have those conversations with these legends
yeah.
who have created these stories that we have grown up reading and are near and dear to our heart is just absolutely amazing. So Terrificon is terrific. It happens every summer at Mohegan Sun. This year is going to be bigger and better than ever. So I can't wait for either one of those shows.
And let me say this, like we say every time we do anything at Mohegan Sun, free parking.
Oh, it can't
free
be said enough.
Parking.
They also have a Krispy Kreme there.
Oh,
if donuts
they
are
do?
Your thing.
I did not
right,
know
no,
that.
I know. I'm preaching to the choir over here. I know that you know about that.
Every time but, I leave there, I walk out with a half dozen donuts.
Yes. Or one of those little cups that has the, you know, the munchkins in it.
Oh,
although I don't know what Krispy Kreme calls them.
Yeah.
They must call them. I'm sure they don't call them munchkins. So yeah, Con's coming up. Now let's talk about Transformers, Matthew. Did you go see the new Transformers movie?
I did not.
Did you see the last Transformers movie?
I dropped off after the second one. First one, I think, is one of the
So once Shia
best
LaBeouf
movies.
Left, you're like, I'm a Shia LaBeouf fan. When he leaves, I'm
yes.
out. I'm not doing Transformers
yep.
anymore. There was an interesting article on ICV2 this week about how the American box office take on some of these big movies is less and less relevant, and it's really become the worldwide stage mm-hmm. that these movies are making their money back on. And so the article reads, the growing difference between the performance of would-be blockbuster films in North America and in the rest of the world was in full view this weekend as Michael Bay's Transformers The Last Knight managed the oxymoronic task of bombing while topping the North American box office, where Wonder Woman continued to be the breakout hit of the summer. Bay's Last Knight, which earned just $45.3 million, over the three-day weekend, which is very low
yeah.
for a movie of that budget, is the fifth Transformers film and the first to open with less than $100 million. So
that's
that
something.
Movie opened at less than half of the other Transformers movies. Let's see. Bay's Transformers The Last Knight debuted on Wednesday and has earned $69.1 million over the five-day opening. Only one of the previous Transformers films, 2011 Transformers Dark of the Moon, debuted on Wednesday and it earned $162.2 million. Even granting The Last Knight two extra days of showings, its debut still represents a 31% decline from the previous Transformers movie Age of Extinction's three-day total in 2014. As far as North America is concerned, the Transformers franchise appears to be on life support, a definite blow to Paramount, which has announced a slate of Transformers spinoff films, Bumblebee is one of them, and which badly needs a hit, any kind of hit, in 2017. Certainly, subsequent Transformers films will have to be made on a much less lavish scale. The Last Knight cost $213 million to produce and millions more to market.
Wow, yeah.
It's a big budget.
Mm-hmm.
Audiences for The Last Knight skewed heavily female. That's not a heavily male, I'm sorry. 57% with 51% over the age of 25. So older males went to see the Transformers movie. But where does it get to the part about the other? Oh, overseas, the situation is quite different, as The Last Knight earned $196.6 million this weekend for a total that includes it had $123.4 million in China, the biggest opening ever for a Transformers
wow.
film in the Middle Kingdom. The film also scored franchise-high debuts in Turkey, Indonesia, and Ukraine, but there appears to be franchise fatigue in some of the bigger overseas markets, such as Russia, Korea, and the UK. Overseas sales have always been important in the modern Transformers films, growing from 55% in 2007 to 77.8% of the global haul in 2014's Age of Extinction. China, where Age of Extinction made $320 million, is the market to watch. Unless The Last Knight can improve on that total, it doesn't appear that Paramount can avoid taking major steps to reboot and scale down the Transformers franchise. So, I mean, the point of that article, two things. Number one, this movie did not perform well as in comparison to the other Transformers movies in North America, but also that the global market has become much more important in the larger picture.
Yeah.
As far as a movie making its money back and setting up future sequels and stuff like that. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the talk over the past few years has been the shared universe that we are now going to see between the Hasbro properties.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, because I believe this was Bay's last Transformers film, I'm thinking anyways they were planning on some sort of a reboot because they would have to start to align those universes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I can't imagine that whatever their future plans are for the shared universe is building off of what Michael Bay did.
And that's sort of like what DC had to do with. You had Man of Steel, which was a huge moneymaker but kind of critically panned. Most people saw it and thought, like me, oh, it was a great movie, just not a great Superman movie. You had Christopher Nolan out of Batman. So you had the first Batman in the franchise without him. They put them together to try to share the universe, and it definitely did what it was supposed to do. It became the spring. Now that's the movie that introduced Wonder Woman.
Right.
Is basically what that movie has now become. So you see that they could easily do that with, all right, let's get the G.I. Joes and Transformers in there together. Maybe we'll throw some masks.
I love the idea. And we're talking about toys here.
Yes.
So by all means, please bring all the toys together in the big toy box.
Yeah.
I'm all for that. And probably better off for not having Michael Bay be a part of that.
Yes.
That's not to say that I've never enjoyed a Transformers film. I certainly have enjoyed them. I was put off by the last one when I went to see it at how – and this is a theme that it has only gotten worse. The thing that I don't like about Bay's movies, and again, Transformers movies that you know kids are going to
–
is the sexual inappropriateness and the sexist type of behavior in the movies, because it's just – it doesn't make any sense to me in the movies at all. So that's the problem I have with them, the fact that they have become increasingly harder to figure out what the actual story is hasn't helped them either.
Yeah.
But I'm ready for that to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, he certainly seems to want to play to every audience – not understanding that if you're going to play to the adults, you don't have to throw in sexual humor like he did, even in the first one, which I thought the first one was as perfect a movie as you can.
Yeah.
But there were two moments in there that were completely cringeworthy because I had my kids with me.
Right.
And Becky and Sammy were young at the time.
Yeah.
They're like, look at all the explosions. What's that mean?
Right.
Ask your mom, because I'm not going to explain that.
And like, if you cut that out of the movie.
It did not hurt the movie.
It didn't take it – right.
It was
didn't
one line. It would be like two lines
that
you had
stupid.
To cut out.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just stupid. So, again, if they're planning on bringing all these franchises together, I would assume they're going to want as wide of an audience as possible to check them out, because at the end of the day, they're probably going to want to sell more toys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. That is a film to me that even despite the critical panning, if I have any interest in it at all – I would go and see it at the movie theater, because if there's a movie made for the movie theater, it's a Transformers movie. Like, to me, renting that on DVD or watching it on Netflix when it comes out doesn't do that any service at all.
You like need the scope and the size.
If you have any interest at all,
yeah,
go see the matinee. Pay a few bucks less for it, but go, you know, go check it out. Anyways, we're going to end the news today, Matthew, on a musical note. No pun intended.
Ooh.
See what I did there?
I like that.
Heavy metal band Iron Maiden is coming to comics. Iron Maiden Legacy of the Beast will debut in Heavy Metal Magazine issue number 287 before making the leap to standalone 5-issue comic series after that. The comic comes from writers Lexi Leone and Ian Eddington and artist Kevin J. West. Heavy Metal issue number 287 will be in stores July 19th. The story draws from the band's extensive catalog and features Iron Maiden's longtime mascot, Eddie, who must battle the legions of the beast as he tries to gather the lost shards of his soul. Heavy Metal recently inked a worldwide distribution deal with Diamond Comic Distributors. Grant Morrison currently serves as editor-in-chief for the magazine. I did not know that.
I did not know that either.
So that's pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah.
What better magazine for an Iron Maiden comic to debut in than Heavy Metal?
And what better band than Heavy Metal or than Iron Maiden to have a comic because Eddie is as iconic as the guys in the band or even the songs.
Sure.
If you have an Iron Maiden, like my youngest daughter could probably name three Iron Maiden songs, could not name anybody in the band, but she knows the lead singer flies the plane, and she could tell you, oh, that's Eddie.
The mascot is more recognizable than the band.
Yes.
Even if you don't know if you've ever heard any Iron Maiden, you know Eddie when you see him.
You know him.
You know what I mean?
I remember with Vin Ferrante from Witch Hunter, Monarch Comics, we were coming back from New York Comic Con. He goes, I have an Iron Maiden comic book idea. So this was last year.
Uh-huh.
He told me this idea, which I thought was amazing. And basically it was Eddie kept getting sent to everything that he was portrayed of in an album cover.
Yep.
So all of a sudden he's in the cockpit of a Spitfire during World War II from the Aces High 12-inch single that came out. Then he transports and he has to keep winning these battles in these different scenes. And I'm like, holy crap, that is awesome.
Yeah.
So
might make a good video game too.
It could. Because there's so much historical references in Iron Maiden songs and the covers. Derek Riggs did the first probably 9 or 10. Man. Can't wait for this comic.
Unbelievable.
Cannot wait.
So that's your news. And before we get into comics, Matthew, we got to talk about Viking Oils, who, of course, have resupplied us with beard supplies. I noticed you're growing your goatee out.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that's only going to get longer.
Yes.
During your 3-week vacation.
It is
gonna. I now am working on some sort of a Kerry King meets ZZ Top look that I have going on right now, where I've shaved the sides of my beard, but I now just have one super long sort of extended goatee on my face now, which some people like.
Yep.
And my family does not.
You should pull a Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick who has his braided.
You know, I thought about that. I also thought about doing the Captain Lou Albano. You know, throw a couple rubber bands in it.
That'd be perfect.
Just rock it. Rock it with that. Or doing the double, like the Viking, the double braids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I could do that too. So so thanks to Viking Oils. You can go to VikingOilsLLC.com to see the latest deals that they have and the latest products that they have, because they change every season.
And the code that they gave us, which I forgot what it is right now, is still active. So if you use the code, I'll put it up on my Facebook page.
Yep, it's a 15% off code.
We'll put up on the Secret Identity page. Everywhere that we can, we will put that code up. You put in the code and you get a percentage off your order. So if you're making that first order, You're not really going to be losing anything if you don't like it, and we guarantee you're going to like it.
Now, speaking of awesome beards, how's this segue?
Wow.
Let's jump into comics, Matthew, for one of the most iconic beards from the cartoon world.
At least.
That has now made the jump to comics.
Yes. So DC has been doing this incredible thing the last couple months where they are taking the Looney Tunes characters, which is all part of Warner's. They all own each other. And they're doing these mashups. The one that I read a couple nights ago was Bugs Bunny and the Legion of Superheroes.
Yep.
So you're taking these iconic cartoon characters and putting them in the situation.
How is it not Bugs Bunny, Captain Carrot?
That would have been a good one.
I mean, how?
So the story in that one was fantastic. It was easy and it made complete sense. They needed Superboy. They shot back the transport ray and it accidentally missed the house and hit the hole that Bugs was living in.
Yep.
And dragged him out.
Makes perfect sense.
So in this one, and it fit in like it could be a cartoon.
Sure.
This one, no cartoon whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
This is Yosemite Sam as a regular dude.
And I want to point out here before I get some angry posts on the Facebook page, Yosemite Sam, it's a mustache.
Yes.
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 Not okay. A beard. I said beard to start off with when we first moved over.
I looked at that.
It is a humongous mustache.
Yes. So written by a guy that knows a little bit about Jonah Hex, Mr. Jimmy Palmiotti.
I love it.
So you've got him, and then you've got Pete Matheny doing the art. Mark Texeira does art in this as well. So starting this off, you're at Cripple Creek, Colorado, and you've got a guy screaming out of the cave, you know, oh, come to Papa, baby. And you see these three guys standing there, and then this little dude. Now, Yosemite Sam in the strip is live. He looks like a real person, but he's about 3 feet tall. And he comes out with this big
golden
nugget.
So he's not cartoonish at all.
Nope, not at all. And he comes out with this big gold nugget going, we is rich. And every time he talks, if he's excited, he goes into that long, using a ton of expressive words.
Sure.
You know, no good, highfalutin, blah, blah, blah,
right,
blah,
right.
blah, 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 blah. He does that with everything he does. So he tells the guys, he brings out the gold and says, hey, we're rich. I'm going to go back in. You guys break camp and come in. We're going to get as much as we can. and then we'll lay claim on this. So the three guys out there are like, you know what? Let's just kill them. We'll kill them. We'll
sure.
split it three ways.
Seems reasonable.
So as they walk in and they're like, you know, you got to come out here. He is standing there waiting with guns drawn, shoots every one of them. And the story is called Come In a Shootin' is
okay.
the story. So he buries the three guys and says, you know, you were my best friends. And I know that greed does this to us, and I'm sorry. So he gets on his horse. He starts driving away. He's going to go to town to lay his claim. And he comes across a horse and a carriage that is in the water, and it's part of a circus. So this woman who's all tattooed comes out going, you got to save him. You got to save him. My friend's in there. And he goes in there, and you see a hand under the water. And he jumps in the water. But first, it's funny because she's like, you need to save my friend. He can't swim. And he's like, all right. And you see him taking off his pants because he didn't want to get his jeans wet.
Did he have his red long johns on?
Yes.
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 Nice. Okay.
And he starts wading
good.
Out to the water.
This is canon then.
Yes.
It's consistent. Yep. Okay, good.
So but the funniest thing is as he's doing this, he's like, oh, hold on a minute. Got to get off my pants. I can't get them wet. And she's like, can you hurry, please? So he gets out there, grabs the hand, and he's like, man, this guy is heavy. As he pulls him out, it's a dude with a beak and a hat. And he's saying, I can't believe.
Shut your mouth.
It's freaking Foghorn Leghorn.
Yes.
So he's saying Foghorn Leghorn.
So far, this is best comic of 2017.
And the best, right? You'll see it. He's got his tail.
Yeah.
So he's up there and he's like, you know, I just got to give you all my gratitude. You saved my life. And he's like, you know, what incarnation are you? He goes, allow me to introduce. My name is Foghorn Leghorn. And he's like, but I don't know where I came from, blah, blah, blah. So they talk about what's going on, and he's like, I'm totally grateful for you, and I'm going to be your right-hand man forever. He's like, look, I don't need that. I just need to go do my claim, but I saved your life. And he also has an eye patch too. So he's part of a traveling circus of freaks, and he goes along. But behind this circus of freaks, as they're saying their goodbyes, is a guy on a horse dragging what looks like a duffel bag, a bloody duffel bag. It is Jonah Hex, and he goes by, and they're all like, oh, my. And, you know, he's like, and just keeps driving. So Hex gets into town. And the interesting thing, Brian, I will show you this. Does that not look like the town that you and I, as Blackie and Elmsford, destroyed?
It does look a little bit like that, yep.
So he goes in there. He drops down this bloody
sack. Must be on the back lot of the WB lot.
Yep. Sack of this bloody sack. And he's like, hey, here's my money, $700. And he goes, well, okay, so I got to identify the body. He's like, yeah, I can't identify the body. There's no head. And he goes, well, he's got a tattoo on the back. So he flipped him over and sees a tattoo. And the guy's like, can you at least tell me how he came to not have a head?
Mm-hmm.
So you see the guy's there, and Jonah goes up to him, and the guy's got a shotgun. He's mouthing off. I'm one more step, and I'm going to. And Jonah kicks him, kicks his hand, the gun. Gun goes up, blows his head off. So that's the story. And the guy's like, well, I can't get the money now. You're going to have to wait a couple days. So as he's there, all of a sudden you see Yosemite Sam show up. He's at the general store getting some supplies, and he also is getting some company, if you know what I mean. So he's getting a bath. He's with a woman, and they're doing some crazy things. And then she goes downstairs because in the moments of passion, he tells her how he found a mine.
Oh,
and he's got
man.
A huge golden nugget. So he goes downstairs. Jonah Hex just happens to be sitting in the bar. So he comes down all relaxed and ready to go. Everybody's looking at him. And then he goes, oh, so you told him about the gold. And then everybody now is making roads to get this gold. They
sure.
want to get the gold. They're going to go after him. But he goes up to the woman who told on him. And he's like, I can't believe you told on me. And he's like, you know what? I think I'm going to have to take care of this situation. She's like, I'll do whatever, please. And he goes, okay, you asked for it. And then he punches her out. So Yosemite Sam punches out a woman right there in the bar. He and Jonah Hex take off. He decides that Jonah, he wants to have Jonah help him. He's going to pay him to help him protect his gold, but they're going to go get somebody else. So who they go get is the bare knuckles boxing champion, Foghorn Leghorn.
So makes perfect sense.
His whole shtick is that he is in the ring, and you've got, if you can survive 2 minutes, you win. So all of a sudden, this crazy dude comes walking in. He beats him up. Now he's out of a job. So they get Foghorn Leghorn. They say, oh, you know what? Why don't you come work with us? Interesting enough, Brian, isn't that the cabin that Jonah lived in that
very,
he built?
Very well might be.
Yep, looks like it is. So this has a lot to do. I mean, it's a wonder Elmsford
feels like a throwback.
Aren't in here. So the three of them are now in Jonah Hex's cabin. And he's talking about, you know, Foghorn's like, oh, you need the love of a good woman. And as Jonah walks out, he's like, well, never had a woman. And you see he walks out and in the clouds, you can see Tallulah, which I thought was really, really cool. Then some bad dudes show up. They all want their money. There's a guy there that has half a scalp because Jonah scalped him and he's still alive. And he's saying, you know what, you guys, we're here for the money. It was the barker for the carnival. Got all the townsfolk saying, hey, if we kill this guy, we get that mine and it's all ours. So they go in there. There's a 4 or 5 page shootout. It's pretty bloody. It's pretty gross. And at the end of it, Jonah and Yosemite and Foghorn Leghorn all save the day. They all have their drink together. They all say goodbye and they all part as friends. It was freaking amazing to see Foghorn Leghorn. Was just fantastic.
And in typical Palmiotti fashion, you know, the Jonah Hex stories are one and done.
Yes.
So this was just another tale for Jonah Hex.
So here is another really cool part of this. You have Dave Alvarez did the art and Bill Hatheny did the script on this one. You now have the cartooned version of a story.
Oh, nice.
So you get, you know, he's out there hunting rabbits, Yosemite, and he's ready to shoot a rabbit, and all of a sudden Jonah Hex is there. He's looking for a huge bear wearing a top hat. And he's like, oh, I've seen him. So the two of them decide they're going to get together and get the bounty. But this is drawn in a style that would be like a Warner Brothers cartoon. Even the coloring is absolutely spot on matching the way a Warner Brothers cartoon would be. And Jonah's face, which was really scarred up in the first story, is not so scarred up here. But a fantastic issue. I paid $5 for this, Brian. It's worth every friggin' penny.
Wow. That's a ringing endorsement.
Amazing.
Well, I am going to go over to Dynamite now and talk about the zero issue of the new Ash versus the Army of Darkness series. Now, Dynamite has done several Army of Darkness series, and usually it is they have a theme, they do a series that runs 10, 12, you know, issues, and then they move on to the next thing. This one has a pretty interesting premise. Now, it is written by Chris Sims and Chad Bowers. The art here is by Mauro Vargas. Colors by Triona Farrell. Letters by Tom Napolitano. And the editor is Anthony Marquez. Now, what you get here when you open up the book is you get sort of a recap of, more specifically, Evil Dead 2, where you see the Necronomicon open up the portal that Ash gets sucked into at the end of Evil Dead 2. And then you see him land in the Army of Darkness world. And you see him go through all of that stuff. You see Sheila. You see the evil Ash. And you get that all within about 3 pages. And what's cool about it is you get, like, you're seeing artwork from the Necronomicon. You're seeing sort of stills from the story of Ash's adventures here as if he is retelling it to someone. And then you turn the page and you see that he is back at S-Mart and he is in the human resources office.
Uh-oh.
And he is sitting down with a guy by the name of Ted Rainsford. Now, Ted Raimi is clearly the guy that he is looking at. Now, what's funny about this is that in the Army of Darkness movie, Ted Raimi is the co-worker that he's telling the story to at the end of the movie. In this version, he is the human resources guy. And so Ted says to him, did you say you cut your own hand off with a chainsaw? And he's like, that's the part of the story that you're concerned with. So anyways, Ted is saying, look, you're missing for a week. And then you come in and on your first day back, you shoot a customer. Because remember, he killed the Deadite.
Yes.
That shows up at the end of the movie. He's like, 7 times with a gun that you didn't even pay for. And he's like, a customer that, you know, this wasn't some coupon clipper. This is a freaking Deadite. She was going to swallow our souls. And he's like, look, frankly, S-Mart can't survive the bad publicity right now. We have to let you go. And he's like, I cannot even freaking believe this. He's like, you know, 2 weeks severance and your employee dismemberment insurance. It's the best I can do. Yeah, thanks. That's great. So the story starts with Ash losing his job at S-Mart, walking out. You go outside. And the car is covered in blood and just all kinds of crazy stuff. People have written graffiti on the side of it. So he goes home and his house is a complete mess. And you see he's making himself something to eat. He gets in his bathrobe and he's kind of just sitting around his house doing absolutely nothing until a woman comes and knocks on the door. And he opens it and she's like, are you Ash Williams from S-Mart? Well, who wants to know? My name's Joanne Wentworth. I need to talk to you about Helen, the woman you killed at the store. And he slams the door in her face. And she knocks again. And he's like, look, you know, if this is some sort of a revenge thing, you're going to have to come back. And she says, no, I need to tell you that that's not what it's about. I'm here because I knew who Helen was. She said, I'm the vice principal over at Alan Shepard High, and she was our librarian.
Oh, I'm seeing it already.
And, you know, until about a month ago, she was like the nicest person that you ever met in your entire life. And then all of a sudden, she started getting really angry, and she started freaking out on people, yelling at the kids, you know. And then it wasn't just her. All of a sudden, some of the teachers started acting strange, and then some of the students, and it would like come and go. You know, they would get crazy. They, you know, all of a sudden these kids are attacking each other. And then afterwards, none of them could remember what happened. And so she says, you know, I think maybe you know something about that. And he's like, oh, I see how it is. You know, you probably saw me in action and you thought I'm the only one that can help you out. And as he's talking to her in the background, the news is on and there's a woman doing a report outside of S-Mart and she's talking about how everybody hated Ash. And so this vice principal's like, yeah, you know, not exactly, but, you know, I can pay you if you can come kind of come to the school, see if you can figure out what's going on. It seems like you have some experience with this kind of stuff. And he says, oh, back to high school, huh? And he looks over at his car, which is in dilapidated shape, and he says, you still teach auto shop over there? And the next thing you know, Ash is strolling into Alan Shepard High School. So I believe he's going to be like a substitute teacher at the school, nice, going undercover while he tries to figure out what's going on. So you flip the page and you get a pretty cool sketchbook of all of the characters that you saw in this first issue here and some advertisements for the previous Ash versus Army of Darkness series that came out. There's also an advertisement in here for the James Bond 007 Moneypenny series.
They've got a couple miniseries that have been going, which
looks
been
pretty cool. Awesome. But this Zero issue you can pick up for 99 cents, Matthew.
Very nice.
And it is definitely worth it because not only does it give you a recap of the Evil Dead movies if you haven't seen them, but it's a pretty cool premise and one that I am going to pick up subsequent issues of because I like that in the comics it's just really about putting Ash in different environments where the Deadite curse has sort of arrived. And so what better place to go than high school?
Perfect. Makes a lot of sense. So the book that I'm going to talk about next is one that I've been really looking forward to for a little bit of time since they announced it. It is Batman 25, and it is The War of Jokes and Riddles Part 1. So it is a extra-sized anniversary issue. It's a little fatter, and it's $3.99. So that's not a horrible thing, simply because you're either paying $2.99 for books or $3.99. And I didn't even notice it, but it's a extra pages. And to give you the creative teams before we even get started in this one, so I got to flip to the last page. I just had it. Tom King did the script. Pencils, inks, and colors is Mikhail Janin. And he does a great job with this, the look of it. June Chung does the colors. Clayton Cowles does the letters. So a book that I have not really warmed up to as much as I've wanted to. To get my Batman fix, I've really been enjoying Detective.
Uh-huh.
This is one that, for me, it just, I know that King is telling longer arcs, much like Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder did. But I really would rather go back to some of the one and dones. However,
did you like the Bane arc?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
That was kind of one where I'm like, to me, it just went a little too long. And this one has a lot of...
I liked it because it reminded me of when post One More Day, they put the classic Spidey villains on the shelf.
Yep.
And then they did the gauntlet and you had creators coming back and making the heroes or the villains of Spider-Man like real serious threats again.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because they had almost become cartoonish
in
some
ways. Bumbly.
And it was like resetting the board on that. And I felt like with the Bane story, it was sort of a reframing of like, here's why Bane hates Batman and is a real threat to him.
Yeah. And this one, what I'm really hoping for is that this is going to bring Batman back to the comic that everybody is really talking about. And you can't get much better than having the Joker and the Riddler kind of squaring off against each other. Because for me, I've always wondered why they didn't. It's always been that thing where Tom King must have looked at this and said, I get to write something that he's probably thought about this too. I mean, I can't be the only Batman fan to ever think, why the two of them don't go at odds against each other, because they're basically the same kind of character. One's more psychotic than the other one, but they both deal with joking and riddles and things like that. So we start off with a comedian who's telling a joke, and all of a sudden you see off camera somebody going, you know, this isn't very funny. And then as the comedian is like, oh, I got better jokes, I swear. And then somebody stands up and shoots him, and he's dead. And he's like, all right, get me clean the stage and get me another one, please. So as he drags the body off stage, he throws the body in a pit of like 15 or 20 other comedians.
Oh.
So this has been going on for a little while. Yeah. And if you are not making the Joker, apparently it's the Joker. I'm just going to assume, but I spoiled that it is the Joker. He's killed a lot of people so far. Now we go to the Gotham jail, and Ed Nygma is being interrogated. Now, the funny part of seeing that is, since Gotham, now everybody refers to him as Ed Nygma.
Okay.
Before, you would just call him the Riddler. You never really mentioned him by name. But because of the way Gotham is set up, it's their characters before they became the bad guys.
Sure.
So a lot of people, if they're reading this, are going to go, oh, Ed Nygma. I get it. That's the guy from Gotham. So he's being interrogated, and he wants nothing to do with this. And something is going on. The guy's like, look, I got 14 dead in Gotham. And it just seems like this is pretty bad. And as Ed Nygma's looking, he's like, do you think this is kind of a joke? He goes, oh, I don't think it's a joke, but, you know, I think that not being a joke is the joke. And he's like, you need to just tell me what's going on. And they're sort of looking, and they're trying to find the patterns. And all of a sudden, as the guy is like, the detective is looking at Ed Nygma, and he's just like, look, you're not helping me anymore. Just going to get rid of you. And the second the guy turns his head on Ed springs out from behind the table, pulls out something from behind his back, and hacks and slashes this dude to death. So this is all on the screen, and people are seeing this. Now we go to a place called the Joke Factory, where there is something going on. There are people being shot at. There's hostages. There's a whole crime scene. You know, they've cordoned off the area. Commissioner Gordon shows up, and he's looking around, and he's trying to figure out what's going on and, you know, what do they got. And before they can even say what the situation is, the building blows up. And as the building blows up, all the detectives and all the cops are looking at the direction of the explosion, and somebody comes from behind and just starts shooting the cops one by one. And he's saying, you know, like the guy, he goes up to one of the dead cops going, a man walked into a bullet, okay? Isn't that funny? Should be funny. Oh, it's not. And then you see him manipulating his face. And he, like, tries to make him smile, and he doesn't. Yeah. So he's, you know, so you're seeing that this is the Joker, and he's very completely psychotic. Now you have a woman comedian, or a woman comes running out, and she comes running out of the place, and the Joker shoots her and kills her, and then he just walks away. So he is doing some bad stuff, but now you actually see it's the Joker. Now you have the Riddler, who's got his green hat on, and as he's walking through, because he was in prison being interrogated, he's now walking through, and all these Gotham cops are here. And this, to me, is the point where at first I'm like, okay, kind of do something, you know, really dazzle me with something. You have the Riddler walking out. There are 8 or 9 heavily armed cops there. They're in their riot gear. They've got the guns on them. And he says, Joanna Elizabeth Sanchez. And one of the cops goes, what? And he goes, oh, yeah. Then he just starts naming names. And one of the cops is like, that's my daughter's name. Somebody else does, you know, he names a bunch. He's like, that's my wife. So he is naming the families of every single cop that is there. And as he is starting to walk by this gauntlet, they're all putting their guns down. Because he's like, you know, one cop's like, you come near my daughter. And he's like, hey, you know what? Good news is I don't have to go near your daughter. So all the cops put down their guns, open up the door, and let him out. And he says something about, you know, when is it bad luck to see a black cat? When you're a mouse. And he walks away. So all of a sudden you have somebody a cab driver driving, and somebody in the back seat is talking, and the person in the back seat you see is the Joker. He shoots the driver while he's driving and being chased, and the car goes careening out of control, hits a bunch of people on the side of the road. He gets out, and somebody is there bleeding that was run over, and the person's like, oh, please help. So he walks up and shoots him. So now you have Ed looking up at a big, tall building in Gotham, and on the 79th floor. He goes up there. He goes into an office, and you see that it – you see the bat signal in the background. I'll show you this, Brian. The art is gorgeous in this book, by the way. Just a great picture. And then you turn and you see on the other side of the room, because it's a huge glassed office, it's the Joker sitting at the desk. And he's like, who's there? And he goes, an answer. So for about three or four pages, you have the Riddler and the Joker kind of battling each other with wits, which I thought was great because that's what the two of them would do. They would instantly not talk to each other. They would start just trying to puzzle and get each other into a corner. And perfect way to put it. So the last part of this is they talk about the two of us, Jones and Riddles. What can we do to make us laugh together? And then they say we can kill the Batman. So that is where you see the two of them are starting to get together. And as they're talking, all of a sudden Batman comes flying through the building and Joker shoots the Riddler. And the Riddler is now laying there. And the Batman goes up and he goes, he took my bomb. The Joker, he took my bomb. He left with the bomb. And then on the last page of it, you see the Joker downstairs walking out. And you see all sorts of villains fighting with each other in the back because chaos is ensuing in the city. And you've got the two of them kind of at odds face to face. So I don't know. The part that I didn't like with this is I got very confused with what the timetable was. There were some moments in here because you turn to the very last page and you've got Batman and Selina laying together. And, you know, she's like talking to him about, so what did you do when this all happened? And he goes, well, what I did, what I had to do during the War of Jokes and Riddles. So I'm like, is this a flashback? I don't know what's going on. To me, it was a really – it's a really great premise. Interesting story. Art is fantastic. What I did not like is sort of – I'm having a tough time following where the story is. The interesting part about that was talking to a couple people online about this book. They had the same issue. That they're kind of following it. Now, maybe this the next issue will all be opened up. I mean, this is a first issue of the arc. But again, really excited about where this one could go. I just thought that this was a little bit of a misstep.
Well, I'll tell you where you don't want to make any missteps, Matthew, and that is around the law.
No, especially in the year 2099.
So we are going to now move into our summer reading project, which for those of you who may be joining us for the first time, we are reading the Judge Dredd Complete Case Files, Volume 1. And many of these stories do not have titles, so I had titled this one for myself, Wandering Walter.
Oh, what a great story.
Because we're going to start off with a story about Walter. Now, what we've been doing is we've been reading probably five or six of these case files for each installment of the summer reading project, and this one will be no different. Although, as you get further into this book, the stories start having titles.
Yes.
And we start seeing more multi-strip stories.
Two things that we will notice in this bunch that we're reading is that fact that we're going to be getting the multiple stories. Because at this particular time in 2000 AD history, Judge Dredd is outpacing everything in there.
Right.
So there, you know what? Let's just get this thing going. The other thing is that I think four or five stories in, we are going to see the fantastic art of Brian Bolland.
Yes. So we're going to start off with a story where Walter is kind of making sure that the judge is all set for the night. Of course, Judge Dredd is laying down reading Crime and Punishment before he goes to bed. And he's like, that'll be all, Walter. Good night. But as soon as Walter leaves, Judge Dredd jumps out of bed and he says, he's gone again. My sneaky robot. Tonight I'm going to follow him.
Yep.
So Judge Dredd decides to go out because he doesn't know what Walter's up to. He's worried about he's kind of flashing back to the fact that over the past few weeks, Walter has been giving him gifts, and he has no idea where Walter is getting the money for these things, and Walter's being secretive about it.
Yep.
So he decides to follow him, and he ends up following him through town until Walter walks into a garage and comes out driving a cab. And it turns out that Walter is moonlighting as a taxi driver. And he's like, hey, can I take you somewhere, buddy? Oh, Quipes, it's Judge Dredd. So Dredd pulls him over and he says, oh, don't be angry. Walter only wants to do it to earn money for you, to buy presents for you. And so Dredd is like, you have got to be kidding me. You're moonlighting and not telling me and going out and driving a cab just to buy presents for me. And as he's kind of scolding him, they get a call over the radio that there is a situation where there's a holdup going on. A cab driver has just been held up. So Dredd says, all right, well, let's get over there. So he jumps into the cab and they speed over there and he jumps out. And it turns out that there was a cab driver that got attacked and they stole his money and everything. And someone's saying, you know, four punks with zit guns beat up the driver and stole his takings. They're holed up in that warehouse. We're going to go get him out. And Dredd says, look, we're not going to have the vigilante situation going on here. I'll go take care of it. So he decides to go in, and of course, Walter's cheerleading over there. That's Judge Dredd. He's the best judge ever. And Judge decides to go, and he kicks the door down. As soon as he gets near where these guys are holed up, they start firing. Of course, the first guy barely gets off a shot, and Dredd kills him.
Yep.
Just absolutely destroys him. Stun shot hits him with. The next one, he dives behind a car because these guys are shooting at him, and he decides to activate a forklift that basically drops a whole bunch of stuff on these guys. Then you got another guy who is laying down on the ground and believes that he has the drop on Judge Dredd, and Judge Dredd kicks a warehouse trolley across the floor and smacks this guy in the face with it, and he ends up rounding up all the crooks. And after he does that, you know, Walter's cheering, oh, this is great, and Dredd is like, shut up and get in the car.
Yeah.
He makes Walter go back and quit his job.
Yep.
And he's saying to himself, like, how in the world did Walter even get this job in the first place? Well, when Walter goes in to tell his boss that he can't work there anymore, the boss says, I hate to lose you, Walt. You are a great driver. And to have you around, if you ever require another job, he talks just like Walter. And Dredd's like, well, I guess if you ask a silly question.
Yep.
And that's the way that one ends. And so the thing I want to remember for this is that when we talk about in our next episode, and we will talk in our next episode about the Judge Dredd 1995 Stallone movie.
Yes.
One of the things that that movie got a lot of flack for was its silliness and its campiness. And I think that these case files, especially these early case files of Judge Dredd, are a real reminder of how silly a lot of these stories were.
Yes.
I mean, you broke the fourth wall in some of these stories where you have Dredd basically advertising 2000 AD comics. You have a lot of the stuff with Walter, which is almost always played for comic relief.
Like Rob Schneider.
Exactly.
You know, you might as well just call Rob Schneider Walter in the movie.
Who is based on a character that appears later that we may not get into in our summer reading project. But that silly tone was there in the comics for sure. Very much so. So now we go over to the next story. And the next story, you have a news reporter saying, this is Al Bristow reporting from MCTV's Hovering Studio here on the east side to witness the saddest of occasions. Below me, I see the funeral procession. They have a funeral procession for Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
Come to find out, Judge Dredd is dead. The story starts with Maria, the landlady, and with Walter being transported in a police transport as the funeral procession for Dredd goes through the streets. And people are saying, oh, who can believe it? Who can believe that Judge Dredd is dead? They get to the monument that they've put up to Judge Dredd. And according to this, he's 33 years old.
Yep.
2066 to 2099. And then they have a judge come up by the name of Judge Gibson. And Judge Gibson is saying, you know, a judge can have few friends. Dredd was mine.
Yes.
We were cadets together. And even then, he was an example to us all. You know, I'm really going to miss him. And so, you know, you've got his fellow officer who's giving a testimonial to him. Then you've got Walter and Maria who go to the memorial site, and they're weeping. They're really having a tough time. And then you see, as people start to disperse, one of the cops is saying, you know, I still can't believe he's dead. He was too good a judge to let himself be caught by that killer. And one of the cops there, who we find out is Judge Gibson, is saying, if only you knew, Dredd had to die because he was too good.
Yep.
So then we sort of see through flashback that there is a judge, and it is Judge Gibson, and he is getting himself into costume, and he's dressing up as a mutant.
Muti the pig.
And in this disguise, he is robbing people, and he's committing all these crimes, and he is doing it without anybody knowing that it's a judge doing it. And so he's going through and doing all this stuff to the point where now the judges are really keying in on him and saying, you know, we got to stop this guy. The chief judge declared a day of mourning. you know, for the dead and all this kind of stuff. And you see that Mutey the Pig is getting quite the reputation. But just when he gets comfortable again, because now that Judge Dredd is dead, Gibson is thinking, there's nothing stopping me. Free reign. Nothing stopping me from going out and committing all these crimes. Well, lo and behold, when he gets a bit too comfortable, all of a sudden, you know, he goes in and he's robbing these guys and he's saying, what, you normals never learn. Anyone else want a Mutey the Pig special? Which is just him shooting you in the face. And he's like, what the? As his gun gets shot out of his hands, you're under arrest, lawbreaker. He turns around, it's Judge Dredd. Now we go into a second strip. So here we see a two-issue or two-prog, you know, sort of Judge Dredd story. And Mutey the Pig is like, what the? How did this? You know, and Judge Dredd goes over and rips the mask off of him. You're under arrest for the Mutey the Pig crimes, Judge Gibson. And he's like, how did that even happen? Well, come to find out that the bullet that Gibson thought he killed Dredd with, he had dodged. And what had happened was Judge Dredd had figured out that Gibson was the culprit because he realized that the way the guy was holding his gun was the way that a judge would hold his gun. And then he realized that there's only three judges that are left-handed in the force right now. And he narrowed it down because two of them are out of town or they're on sabbatical or whatever. So he narrowed it down to it was Gibson. Well, Gibson saw Judge Dredd going through the tapes and finding out who it was. And he knew that Dredd figured out that it was him. So he shot and killed Dredd, or so he thought. Well, it turns out Dredd dodged that bullet and he ended up living. And that is how he figured out that it was him. And so after all that happens, Gibson's like, well, you know, we kind of had a deal that whenever we had a difference, we were going to settle it between the two of us, just me and you.
Like boxing back in the old days.
Yeah, just like we did in the academy.
Yep.
You know, and when we had that fight in the academy, we said, whatever happens, no matter what happens down the road, we're going to solve our problems, you and me.
No law, no nothing.
No law, no nothing. And so basically, Judge Dredd decides not to take this guy in because he made an oath.
Yep.
He told this guy, we're going to settle this between the two of us. So I guess we have to settle the fact that you're a murderer between the two of us. We're going to have to fight to the death. So they decide that they're going to go to the academy, just like old days, and they're going to have a fight to the death. And they end up fighting in an area that is basically like a sound studio recreation of a block of Mega City.
Yes.
And so they go in because it's where they train judges.
Yep.
And so they go in and they're going to fight each other. And the fight is a little bit anticlimactic because you have the two of them facing off like duel style.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Gibson saying, stop wasting time. Let's get this showdown over with. And or Judge Dredd says that to him. And he says, anything you say. And he pulls out the gun and fires a heat seeker, which Judge Dredd knows that is going to come back to get him. So he fires a heat seeker of his own and cancels that one out. Now, you know, the two of them have to take cover, and Dredd switches over to ricochet bullets. And he ends up ricocheting a couple bullets off and hitting Judge Gibson. And he's following the blood trail because Gibson now has gone around the corner, up a flight of stairs. He doesn't know where he is. And Gibson ends up getting the high ground on him and getting the drop on him. He's like, wrong, Dredd. I doubled back. Now, where do you want it? You want in the head or the heart? And Dredd's like, well, you know what? He got me down cold, but I'm going to go out fighting. And he whips around and fires off a shot and ends up shooting Gibson. And Gibson falls off the ledge, and now he's dying. And Dredd basically goes in and grabs this guy and kind of cradles him in his arms. And he's like, you had me. Why didn't you fire? He says, it was hard enough to kill you once. I couldn't do it again. You were my friend. It's better this way. You know, I couldn't have faced 20 years on Titan. Goodbye, old buddy. And so you see that this guy couldn't really bring himself to kill Dredd. And he didn't want to go to jail, so he figured this was the best way to go out, was to let Dredd kill him, basically.
And my favorite part is how it ends, because Judge Dredd gives him a touching tribute by going to the wall of cadets that graduated with him and smearing his name.
Erasing him from existence.
Never happened.
Yes. Yep. It was a bitter victory. Judge Gibson was my friend. But then we erase him from existence.
But not so much.
And no one will ever know that again. So that's that story. Then we flip over to another story, and it's kind of like a Night of the Living Dead type of story,
yeah,
where you have on the streets of Mega City, all of a sudden creeping out of the darkness are these almost decaying looking people who have really big eyes, and they kind of crawl out of the shadows and they start kidnapping people and dragging them back into the shadows.
And they talk like hippies. They're like 60s, you know, hey, hip to the scene, daddy-o, and
right,
all that crazy stuff.
And they start taking people away, and then you know, Dredd is patrolling around and someone comes up and says, it's horrible. They just grab these poor people and drag them off. And Dredd says, too many people have been disappearing lately. I may be able to pick up their trail on the heat beam. So he uses the is it the Law Master?
Is the motorcycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uses the functions of the Law Master, the infrared headlamp, ends up tracing their footsteps down into kind of an old subway station. So he ends up going down, drives right down the stairs, of course, because he's not going to leave his bike outside.
Nope.
He drives in. No sooner does he get in the subway station than literally coming out of everywhere are these people who, again, look like almost half zombified. And they end up completely overwhelming him to the point where he can't get away. He can't function with his weapon. They end up knocking him out. And they ended up taking him to another part of the station. And they're talking about Slick Willie. We're going to take him to Slick Willie. Well, it turns out as they drag Dredd into this particular area, there are people who have basically been put to work by these zombified creatures. And they call them the Troggies.
Yes.
I'm guessing as in troglodyte. But yep. they call them the Troggies. And these are people who and it's almost like the Futsies. Now, the Futsies were people who, when the future technology and sort of advancement of mankind started to really start to move ahead very quickly, the Futsies were people who couldn't handle.
And they basically kind of reverted back to a safer time.
The Futsies were the people that kind of went stir crazy.
Yeah.
And they became like berserkers.
Okay, now, I'm thinking something else. Yeah.
The Troggies are the ones who also, when they saw the technology of the future, decided they didn't want to be a part of that, and they kind of left society and went and lived underground.
Yeah.
And so they've become almost like the Morlocks in the X-Men sort of thing. They've become adapted to living underground. So they kind of have – their eyes have gotten bigger. They can see in the dark, and they've kind of started to mutate a little bit because they've been away from – technology, and they've been sort of out of the limelight, and that's why they talk like they're from different eras, because they still have the vernacular and the trends and the clothes
yep.
and the hairstyles of all of these different eras that they came down out of society with. And so Dredd gets captured, and they're going to put him to work down here. And so Slick Willie is a guy who says, groove it, daddy-o, you know, kind of talks like I'm assuming like a greaser.
Yeah.
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 And he is, although he's dressed a little bit like Colonel Sanders, and he's like, that's who they are. Weird types from the 20th century who couldn't adjust to the furious pace of modern life. The story goes that they took refuge underground, and as time passed, their bodies warped to adapt to their new world.
Which was dark and mysterious and gross.
Yep. And so they've decided that they are going to now reclaim the surface world, and they're going to do that by sending out a car with explosives in it. And they're basically going to bring Mega City down in one fell swoop. And basically they're going to rule after that. And so Dredd at this point is in chains. He's being forced to work. He has no ability to save anybody. And they are about to enact their plan. So then we go over to the second installment of the story, because this is another one that has now flipped over to two particular issues or progs rather. And so as we get into the second story, he's being held captive. He doesn't know how he's going to get out of here, but he knows if he doesn't, then he's got like 10 minutes to save Mega City before it explodes and gets brought down into the subway system. And so what does he do? Classic Matthew.
Yep.
When you're in a cell with someone else, when you want to cause a diversion in order to have something else happen, you pick a fight.
You do.
And so that's what he does. He goes over to a guy who's chained up next to him and says, the guy says to him, well, you're a judge. Why aren't you doing something? It's your job. And he says, what do you expect me to do, meathead? You know, you're ugly. I ought to arrest you for showing yourself in a public place like this. And of course, the guy gets upset. Then they start fighting. Judge Dredd lets him punch him. They get ripped out of their shackles. He gets thrown across the room. And lo and behold, he lands near the laser drill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he turns around with that laser drill and he uses it on his captors. And he ends up fighting his way out of there. But now you have the fact that there's this cart full of explosives that is racing toward the middle of the city and going to blow everything up. And the guy that has the detonator button is Slick Willie. And so even though Dredd gets out, you know, he runs into Slick Will and he says, "You're just in time to see the big action." And he says, "How can I see it, Slick Willie, if there isn't any light?" And then he turns on the lights of one of the subway cars and blinds them all. And he says, "You know, just as I thought, the Troggies have been so long in the dark, they can't stand the strong light. It's blinded them." And you have Slick Willie saying, "You just lost, Fuzz. Nothing stops the final rumble now." And he's about to hit the button on the detonator. Judge Dredd uses a whip that is electrified to wrap it around this guy's neck. And when he does, the guy drops the detonator and Judge Dredd catches it. And the next thing you know, he calls in the cavalry. They end up arresting all these guys. And, you know, they're saying, "We could sure rest easier now, Judge Dredd, to think these weirdos have been living under our very noses all this time. You don't have to look in the subways to find creeps as dangerous as the Troggies. Mega City is full of people with an axe to grind. As long as they exist, no judge can ever rest easy."
Yep.
So, I mean, man, just it never ends for Judge Dredd.
No, and this one is one of my favorite beginnings of any Judge Dredd story ever.
Yes.
Where you've got
you've
got the two judges, Judge Dredd and another judge, break into somebody's house.
Yeah.
Kick open the door as a mother is putting their baby to sleep. And,
what does she tell the kid as she puts him to sleep?
Oh, man, I got to find. Oh, she's telling him about, you know, if you don't sleep, Judge Dredd's going to come get you.
So Judge Dredd is literally a horror story.
He's a threat to these kids. So all of a sudden, he shows up and he opens up the door. He's going, "Where's Billy Jones?" And all of a sudden, the mother's like, "He's right here. I'm just trying to put him to sleep." They grab him from the mother and the two judges proceed to pull him apart. And she's like, "What's going on?"
They drag the kid out. They pull the woman's son out of bed. And then he says to Judge Giant, who is the other judge that's working with him, "Twist it to the right, Judge. Loosen the insides." And they pull the kid's head off to the horror of the mother.
Because the mother doesn't know it's a robot.
Right.
She's still assuming it's her kid. And
she's like,
"Oh
my God, a robot." And he says, "Industrial espionage, ma'am. Your husband is the chairman of Plastoid Industries. Someone kidnapped the real Billy and substituted a robot spy to steal your husband's secrets." I mean, that's some good industrial espionage.
It's an ingenious way because you steal the kids, you put listening and seeing devices. So, "Hey, Dad, what are you working on?" "Oh, I'm working on this top secret." Guess what?
Yep.
Not top secret anymore.
So now you can assume that, and we find out a page later, that this has happened to many CEOs of many companies. All of their children have been replaced by robots, and all of the kids are being held captive, where you have this guy who is Hugh Howard's.
Yeah, big fatty boompa laddie.
And up in a penthouse somewhere, and he's talking about how these are the chairman of Mega City's top 20 industries. We're going to take all the information that they have, and we're going to make our company better than everybody else's. So you've got all the kids that are, you know, screaming and crying for their parents, and he sends a robot around to shove food in their mouths as they're going. And he's like, you know, basically bragging that they pulled off the screen, the scheme, and all of a sudden Dredd kicks the door in, and they show up, and most of the guys go down pretty easy, but the main guy, Hugh Howard's, escapes with Billy, the kid that started this all, and he takes him out of there. So Judge Giant is in smacking the crap out of everybody, and he ends up chasing this guy out. And when he chases this guy out, he's standing on a ledge where he has Billy, and he's about to throw him over if Judge Dredd doesn't let him get away. And all of a sudden, the two of them tumble off the side of the roof, and they're both going to die. But Judge Giant reaches down and grabs Billy at the last minute, saving him, and the other guy falls to his death. So as they're watching this on television, you see another family's at home saying, "You know, if you ain't a good boy, Judge Dredd will come get you too."
Yep.
So you can see that no matter what Judge Dredd does, no matter how much good that he does, he's always going to be a nightmare story that parents tell their kids.
Yep. And then coming up the next time we talk about it, we have one of my favorite stories.
Yes.
With the gorilla gangs.
Don Uggie.
Oh, classic.
Your homework for two episodes from now is going to be to read from this Don Uggie story that is the next one that you're going to see up through the story that starts with the word "futsy" on it, which we just talked about the "futsies."
Yep.
That's going to be the next one that you read through. In fact, it's after Red Christmas. There's one more story. 22nd Century Futsy. That's the one you're going to read through. So that's the next chunk of Case Files that you are going to read through for our summer reading project. But for next episode, your homework is to do the first installment of the summer watching project, which is to watch the 1995 Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd movie.
Yep.
And we will be talking about that next episode. So before we wrap up, though, We have a creator spotlight this week.
Action-packed.
Those of you who have listened to this show for a long time know Alana Abbott. She is the author of the Redemption Trilogy. We have had her on the show many times back, even when we used to do a gaming segment on the show. Her and Max Saltonstall used to come on and do segments with me on the show. In addition to the Redemption Trilogy, she has worked on some of the Choice of Games series, and she also is the editor-in-chief of Ragnarok Publications. Now, we just talked about the Warlock 5 series that is coming through Ragnarok Publications. So she reached out to me because she had written a fairy tale that ties into a new board game that is going to be coming out from Foxtrot Games. And that's where we bring in Randy Hoyt, who is the owner of Foxtrot Games. They have put out such games as Lanterns, World's Fair 1893, and Relic Expedition. They are putting out a new game on July 19th called The Fox in the Forest. And it is a trick-taking card game. And in this particular interview, you are going to hear both Alana talk about the story that she wrote for this game, the fairy tale, and you are also going to hear Randy not only talk about this particular game, but also the company and the work that they've done and how he got into doing board games and card games and things like that. And it's a great interview because the thing that always impresses me about Alana is how many different types of projects that she's done work for. And I'm going to put a link in our show notes to the fairy tale that she wrote for The Fox in the Forest because it's amazing. And you can go and read it for free, and then you can check out what the game's all about, and then you can get the game on July 19th. And if you're going to Gen Con, which is obviously a huge gaming convention, you'll be able to get it there as well. So Randy Hoyt of Foxtrot Games and our good friend Alana Abbott are your creator spotlight this week. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letendry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here, and I am very fortunate tonight to have a new friend and an old friend on the show, Alana Abbott, who most of our listeners are familiar with from the Redemption Trilogy, and also the work that you've done in A Choice of Games and a whole bunch of other stuff that you've come and talked on the show from the old gaming segment that we used to have on Secret Identity going back many, many years, which we were sort of just talking about. You are here with us, and you brought along a friend today, Randy Hoyt from Foxtrot Games. How are you today, Randy?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And when Alana reached out to me and said that she was had just written a fairy tale for an upcoming board game that was coming out this July, I was very excited not only to talk to her about that, but then she extended the offer to get a chance to talk to you as well. So I'm pretty excited about that because when I found out that this was a trick-taking game, I was immediately intrigued because I grew up playing what I called here setback, but then I found out when I got outside of Connecticut that people call that pitch in other places, but I sort of grew up playing setback. And so as soon as I heard a trick-taking game, I was kind of excited. And as soon as I learned a little bit more about The Fox in the Forest, which is the game that you guys are getting ready to release, it felt in many ways very familiar, and I was super excited about that. But before we jump into the actual game piece of it itself, can you tell us a little bit about Foxtrot Games and how you guys have sort of released some pretty amazing games over the past few years?
Yeah, so in my day job, I'm a web developer and played a lot of board games. Board games have been under a bit of a resurgence. I think a lot of people are familiar with Ticket to Ride or Settlers of Catan, and they've kind of helped fuel this resurgence of board games in the last decade or so. I was playing a lot of games and playing with my brother, who is an artist, and we thought, we could make a game. And with the rise of Kickstarter, it seemed like a really good path to create something, put it up on Kickstarter, see how that whole process worked, raise money, maybe produce something, real. Most of the stuff I do at work is digital and not tangible. Can just disappear in a heartbeat and no one will miss it. There's nothing physical about it. So we started, how many years ago was this? 5 years ago, probably, working on what would become our first game, Relic Expedition. We raised money on Kickstarter and put it out the following year. So that's been about 4 years, 4.5 years ago that's been out. We weren't really sure if we were just going to do one game or more, but I just really loved the process. I loved playtesting games and working on them and turning them into products. So the role I've carved out for myself in the industry is that of a publisher or design development studio. So I've been meeting with other game designers and signing their games, kind of like with books, with publishers. You know,
sure.
an author will write a manuscript and then submit it to a publisher, and then they'll work with an editor to make it the best book it can be. The game industry is a lot like that. So I work with designers like authors as an editor myself, and help them make those games the best they can be, and work with artists to get the packaging and the artwork and all that ready to go, and then bring the games to market. Probably our most popular game is called Lanterns: The Harvest Festival. It came out 2 years ago, I guess. We raised money for Kickstarter with that, and partnered with another distribution publisher, and have got pretty wide reach with that. It was on Tabletop, Will Wheaton Show.
Yep.
And we've won some awards, and it's really done really well for us, and it's allowed us to sort of keep coming out with new games. We've come out with a new game each year. We did an expansion to Lanterns last year, and now Fox in the Forest will be our fifth product release.
And Fox in the Forest is coming out on July 19th, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So we had a few copies at Origins that we'd airmailed in from China, but...
that's awesome.
Yeah. It sold out in 10 minutes, which sounds really impressive, but it was very few copies.
But I think that speaks well of you know, the games that you've already put out, and I think people getting excited about a new product from you. And you mentioned that that you've gone the Kickstarter route and that's been successful. I would imagine with that first project like 5 years ago, that was kind of the period of Kickstarter where people were still figuring things out in terms of like budgets and, you know, did we plan enough and did it cover all the back end costs and things like that. I would imagine that you learned quite a few lessons on that first project.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about it now like the early days or the Wild West of Kickstarter, those first few years. And I mean, tabletop games on Kickstarter has become a really mature space. And it's very well funded. There's lots of money running through there for projects now. And a lot of studios are really, you know, professionals putting out their 20th, 30th games through there, which is a lot different than it was back then. I wasn't at the very beginning, but it was still... You could put up a game that wasn't quite finished and get people excited about bringing an indie game in. And that still happens, but there are a lot more, you know, established studios these days running Kickstarter projects for board games.
So let's talk a little bit about The Fox in the Forest and Alana, how you got involved with this particular project. Did you know of Foxtrot Games before you started working with them on this project?
Oh, absolutely. Randy and I go back. Not quite as far as you and I go back, Brian, but we met several years ago at MythCon, which is the Mythopoeic Society's conference that talks about mythology and the Inklings, and also has just awesome fantasy papers that are scholarly and also fun. It's a really neat hodgepodge between a fan con and a scholarly conference. And it was through that context that I met Randy for the first time. And at the time he was running a website, Journey to the Sea, right, Randy?
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
And I wrote a few essays for that about King Arthur, and it was really fun. Also about gaming and fantasy and gaming and how it's a work of creation to invest yourself in a game. So I knew Randy from that context, and then as soon as Foxtrot Games launched, I was up on those Kickstarters. Not able to pony up the full funding, but be like, here, Randy, here's a dollar. I want to keep up with what you're doing, which is often how I approach Kickstarters these days. Like, oh, I don't have it right now, but keep me informed. I want to know what's going on. So, as Fox in the Forest was getting sort of in the art planning stages, Randy said, hey, do you know any artists that you would recommend? And I know a lot of artists.
Sure.
So I sent him a list. And that seemed to be going very well. And then he said, you know, we're thinking about doing something different with this game. And we're thinking about having a fairy tale that wraps into the way the game plays out and the different characters in the game. And would you be interested in doing something like that? And I was like, yes, of course I would be interested in doing something like that. So then Randy sends me this email that's like, well, it needs to include all of these elements. And there's a list of like 13 different elements that have to go in a short story. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be awesome. And I have no idea how to do this.
It's like the days of those like 48-hour short story challenges. Like, here's a line and here's a prop and here's a thing that you have to use in the story.
No, but it ended up being awesome. I brought it to the dinner table and my family and I all talked through like, okay, what elements, how can this all work together? And we hashed out a plot as a family, which is the first time we've ever done that. And it was super exciting. And then I ended up putting the pieces together and I wrote this fairy tale, which I think came out really well. I'm very pleased with it.
So Randy, on your end, like how was that for you? Like throwing those pieces out there and then sort of seeing what Alana came back with, because I've been fortunate enough to be reading her writing for, you know, over a decade now. And she hits to all fields, like whether it's essays, whether it's novels, whether it's short stories, whatever. So when I read The Fairy Tale, like it didn't surprise me at all that it captured that wonderful sort of fantastical vibe. But what did you think when you got that back from her?
Well, I loved it. And I mean, what was great about it was that as we were developing the game, I mean, the reason why I wanted to have a fairy tale is twofold, probably. The, you know, games are, a lot of people, especially designers of games, think about them in terms of mechanics, and there's a lot of math and balancing. But when you play a game, you're evoking a world, you're entering into an atmosphere. And unlike reading a book, you're actually making choices and interacting with that world. And so I wanted to make, I mean, it's a trick-taking game. It's cards with numbers and suits, and it could be very dry and abstract. But I wanted it to really pull people into a world. So I wanted to make that world as rich as it could be. And so all the, you know, all the face cards, basically, it's all the odd cards in this game. So there's 11 cards in each suit, three suits. It's a small deck for two players, and all the odd cards have special abilities when you play them. And, you know, we were trying to tie them to fairy tale tropes or characters. And, you know, we were coming up with what we thought were really clever abilities, like the why would, when you play the fox, you can change the trump suit because the fox is really sneaky and clever. And we wanted, that one was pretty obvious and easy, but we wanted to find ways to tie all of these abilities to characters to make them easier to remember. And we thought a fairy tale, having a story behind it would really help ingrain both the atmosphere and make you feel like you're in the setting, and also make it easier to remember what the cards do without having to read them all. I mean, they all have the text on there, but we wanted it to become second nature. So that was the reasoning. And I was thinking back to one of my favorite novels is Lord of the Rings, and there's a lot of scenes in there where they mention things from Tolkien's Legendarium, the Silmarillion stories, that, and they're like this backdrop, and it just feels very, just you read these sentences and you don't know who the characters are. You're like, who is Turin? Who is Baron? But you just like feel this, like there's something richer here. And so through the rule book, I mean, one of the things I really wanted out of the story was excerpts that we could put throughout the rule book. So as you're reading, you know, the witch does this and you're like, there's some rich world behind here. And we really wanted to paint that sort of picture in all of this. So when the story came in, I kind of imagined, you know, as we came up with the characters, there's a woodcutter, there's a witch, there's a monarch, you know. So I kind of had tied the characters to the powers and things they might do in a story. And I had basically sketched out in my own mind a story like Hansel and Gretel, but with more characters, and how it might play out. And then the story came back totally different than that. And it was just like... It was like finding an old story in a library, and you're like, what is this, and where is it from, and what language is it translated from? What is this mystery, and is there a book of tales I can find with more stories of this world?
Not yet, but maybe one day.
Maybe one day.
I think your story really does that, Alana, and what I love about it, and you know, you mentioned the rule book. You can go, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the website now, and you can read the rule book, and you have embedded those snippets of story throughout. You can go to the Foxtrot Games website and you can read the fairy tale that we're talking about right now. And I think it's probably safe to say, I know Alana and I are both D&D nerds. I'm assuming that you've played D&D in your lifetime as well?
A little bit. I'm definitely more on the mechanical side of board games than on the role-playing games, but I have done a little dabbling and want to do some more. definitely steeped in fairy or in fantasy type literature.
Well, that's interesting because you sort of have brought that world building sensibility to a board game, in which is what I look for in any property, whether it be a video game or, you know, role playing game or a board game or anything. I always love that backstory. I want the world. In fact, Alana and I first, you know, when we first started talking, it was around the world building that she was doing for a particular RPG at the time. And that is what always draws me in. So having this fairy tale that gives you a little bit more of a glimpse into that world, to me, just helps bring that whole thing to life. And what I liked about the fairy tale is it leaves you with questions about these characters and wanting to know more, like the lumberjack himself. Like you get a feel for who, kind of what type of character he is, but there's a lot of unanswered questions about him as well. And so it was just really neat to read that fairy tale, which I think, again, builds the world of the game so nicely, but also leaves plenty of room for other stories to happen. And it gives that sense of like, there is a lot more to this world, and we haven't seen that yet. And that, to me, sucks me right into a game. And then having it have mechanics of games that I'm familiar with was really exciting as well. And I was watching a video review of someone sort of playing through a hand of the game, and it felt very familiar to anyone who's played a trick-taking game before. But the artwork is absolutely beautiful. You mentioned the abilities that are on the odd-numbered cards in the game. All of that stuff just feels like it adds this additional layer to the game while not feeling overwhelming. And so when you combine that, the mechanics that kind of draw you in, and then this sort of world-building that you've done too, it just feels like a really robust game.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a challenge in, I guess, today's market for board games, is that people want a lot of new, innovative, fresh things. And so anytime you bring a game out, it's got to have something unique and fresh. But I also really like the classic feel of old games. And so, you know, the reviewers, I mean, all the reviewers so far, it's not out yet, so there's a few review copies, but they all said that exact same thing. It feels like a classic game, but it has this new modern twist, and it's exactly what I was going for. And it's just great to hear reviewers pick up on that.
And really, the art really is beautiful. As I was, Randy would send me these, here's the draft of what's going on with the art. And it's by Jennifer Meyer, who Brian, you also know from the Chronicles of Ramlar.
Oh my goodness. Yes, absolutely.
She goes way back. Also, that's where I knew her from.
I was just going to say, like, there is a circle of artists that you certainly have, that circle has grown much bigger over the years, but it's good. Sure. It's always awesome to hear names. And that was, that was the project that you and I sort of met around.
That's right. That's right. But so Brandy would send me these little snippets of art, and I'd be like, oh, these are amazing. What can I do to evoke what's going on in Jennifer's work? She's got such beautiful stuff coming through. So.
Yeah, it feels very dreamy, and it feels very the coloring is just absolutely gorgeous on those cards. So they just they have this feel of like that they've been around for a really long time, which I think is super cool.
Yeah, working with Jennifer was great. There's a lot of artists in the board game space, and they do a lot of board games. And, you know, people will look up a favorite artist, and they'll ask them, hey, do you want to do the art for my game? But I've always wanted to find new artists who haven't done board games and bring some of that outside influence in. And, you know, we've done that. My brother did the artwork for our first game, the Relic Expedition. He hadn't done a board game before. We found a really good artist who's now done a lot of board games, but at the time she hadn't done a lot of board games yet. And then Jennifer bringing her in for this game, it just really, you know, it just doesn't look like board game art usually looks. And I think that helps bring in sort of that fresh perspective for the game.
So, I mean, you have this game that you have developed, and you've got the world building going on around it, and you have this amazing product. And board games have gone through this resurgence now, but even with that, it's so difficult to get your signal out amongst the noise of, like, you know, letting people know about a new project, spreading the word about a new project. I mean, obviously, we're talking here in terms of a podcast interview tonight, and you mentioned the connection to having one of your games on Will Wheaton's Tabletop. Like, is that where you go primarily now to sort of spread the word is sort of the grassroots movement of podcasts and sort of video reviews and things like that. Like, what works in terms of getting your game out there?
Yeah, well, a couple of things that I've done, I guess, with the Kickstarter campaigns, it's definitely grassroots movement. There's a lot of board game enthusiasts on Kickstarter. It's really done a lot for the hobby to help grow it and bringing in more and more people in. And so there are review channels, social media. Twitter has a great board game community that I'm a pretty active member of. And then, you know, if you can get a big enough following and get the game funded on Kickstarter, Kickstarter will help drive a lot of traffic there. They don't help as much just get the game funded, but once it's funded and starts doing well, that will then start to attract more people. And sort of the landing pages have those, you know, the stats about how quickly it was funded or, you know, how much over its goal it is. So, you know, there's a lot of people in board gaming that want to talk about games, that want to talk about Kickstarters. It's still an exciting place for talking about new games. And going to conventions, you know, I run events at conventions. Most conventions have open gaming hall, and I usually get, you know, I try to get a good box cover first so I can put up a big pop-up banner that draws people in, you know, draws with lanterns. People would come across the hall like, what is this game?
Which is awesome. Yeah, because you got to draw them to the table first, and then when you have those mechanics that are going to suck them in.
Yeah, the other big thing that I've done is after Lantern's Kickstarter campaign, there was a guy who named Scott Gaeta who owns Renegade Game Studios. He's an industry veteran. He's been around for many years and worked with a number of big properties. He worked at Upper Deck for a while. He was one of the co-founders of Cryptozoic. And he had just started his own company and wanted to get a few products out. And so he talked to me about co-publishing. And so we've co-published every game with him since Lanterns, so all but the first one. And so he's got really great industry connections for distribution and retail. And so that really helps get the game in more stores, get it on more people's radar. And so those two approaches have been great for us, getting modest-sized Kickstarters. I mean, they fund and they go double or triple their goal, but we're not talking millions of dollars or anything. But, you know, getting enough people to back and to get the game and play it and start leaving positive reviews on social media, on Board Game Geek, those places, really, and then follow up with their great retail push has really helped propel all of our games into a pretty good place. We just had our most recent game before this one, World's Fair 1893. It was nominated for Board Game of the Year at the Origins Awards, which was pretty crazy to me.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
It didn't win, but this was definitely it's an honor to be nominated.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a pretty light, casual game. It's like 30 to 40 minutes, and the game that won, you know, these are like hour and a half, 2 hour games with tons of pieces. And so it was definitely an honor to have our game. And, you know, World's Fair 1893 was a great one because the world was already built. There were tons and tons of exhibits and great architecture. And so we were able to tap into that rich history from the Chicago World's Fair. The Ferris wheel, the board is a Ferris wheel, and the Ferris wheel car goes around the board as a timer in that game. And,
that's cool.
You know, tapping into that, the world was already built, and we could help bring it to light a bit more, bring it back from the history books.
Well, and you mentioned that, you know, going to conventions and showing the game off and letting people get hands-on with it is certainly a great way to get the word out about the game. What's your sort of con schedule look like coming up? I know the game's coming out on the 19th, so I would imagine you've got some events planned over the summer, including the big one?
Yeah, the Dice Tower Con is the next event where the game will be available. I won't be there personally, but Renegade Games has a booth there, so you can get it there. And then the big show for me this summer will be Gen Con. So we'll be running events with the Fox in the Forest, as well as Lanterns and World's Fair. And we'll also be playtesting an upcoming release called Spy Club. It's a cooperative game where you play neighborhood detectives trying to solve neighborhood mysteries.
Oh, as an Encyclopedia Brown fan, that makes me very, very happy.
Yeah, exactly. It's set in that world. And it's got kind of a campaign structure, so you can play multiple games in a row and unlock new modules and get new mechanics, kind of like mini expansions to play. And so you can play a big five-case campaign. All the cases connect together to tell like a bigger story.
And for people who may not be getting to any of those cons this summer and may not get a chance to sort of see the game in person, where's the best place for them to not only find out news about the release and get a copy for themselves, but to keep up with all the projects that you guys are working on?
Yeah, so our website is foxtrotgames.com. We have a newsletter link there. We send out monthly or so newsletters. And then Twitter and Facebook, we're Foxtrot Games there. We post more often than monthly there with announcements and previews of artwork and links to the rule books and all that.
Fantastic. And I'll put links in the show notes because, like I said, Alana's Fairy Tale is up there. The rule book is up there. You can go and really learn a lot about the game there. And Alana, I don't want to give you short shrift on this interview because we've been talking a lot about...
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm excited to hear more about the game because I haven't had a chance to play it yet. So I've been watching the development phase and I'm like, Randy, when am I going to get my comp copy so I can play it? And he's been very patient with my, when am I going to get to play questions?
That's what's sort of fascinating for me about the work that you do with some of these games is that quite often you're doing some of this world building or you're writing a story for these games and you're sort of watching that get woven into the game almost like from afar.
Yes.
Right. And so
yes.
that's like it's got to be like a mixture of pride and excitement and also like anticipation. Like how is that to sort of see that coming together from afar?
I get kind of fanish about it, I guess. It's like I'm just enough on the inside on a lot of this, the projects that I do that are like this, where I'm not the designer, but I'm involved in some aspect, that I get really excited about what everybody else is doing. And so I'm like waiting in the wings with the crowd that's also chomping at the bit to get a hold, going, yay, I'm so excited. So, yeah, there might be squeeing.
Well, and one of the things of working with artists who haven't done a lot of board games is that they often don't play board games. So, I mean, Jennifer's not played The Fox in the Forest. We're working with a new artist on this upcoming game we have as well. And, you know, she hasn't played it. And, so it's a tricky challenge. You know, we work with a graphic designer to also help make sure the games are playable, you know, make sure the interface of the game is there. I mean, when you think about writing a book, the interface for a book is sort of figured out, right?
Right, right.
You have the pages. You don't have to, like, think about, well, what do they do after they read this page? What should they do next? Should it be a card? Should it be a video clip? Like, what should we do next? But with games, the trick-taking game is pretty straightforward. The interface is based on standard decks of cards. But some of our other games, you know, it's all the time. Should this be a square token? Should this be a card? Should the board go this way or that way? Or should it not even be a board? Should we have this over off to the side? And that can be tricky with artists who haven't played the game. And so usually I'll rely on a graphic designer to sort of sketch out what we need and sort of communicate, here's where the icons are going to go. We need the art to go in here. And sometimes I've had the artwork done first, and the graphic designer tries to retrofit interface around it.
Sure, and that was actually going to be one of my questions too, is like, was this a game where you were very clear on the mechanics ahead of time? Like, this is the game that we have. This is exactly, we know exactly how the game's going to work. We know all of the mechanics, and now we want to build the story and the lore around it? Or was it that you had this sort of idea for, a concept in terms of the lore and built a game around it? Like, I would imagine it would be different with every game, but the whole like chicken and the egg thing.
Yeah. So for most of our games, we have the mechanics figured out roughly. And then we try to either come up with a theme or layer on a theme. So with Lanterns, it had a different theme when we first started working on it. World's Fairy 293 also did. With Fox in the Forest, it was, I guess the designer had played it with a different theme, but when he pitched it to me, he said, I want this to be a fairy tale game. And because I love foxes, there's Foxtrot Games, you know, the fox is my logo. He said, well, we could make the three a fox for you, if that would help.
it works so beautifully.
Right.
Yeah. And so we had a pretty good sense of how the game would play. Now, if this were my full-time job, I imagine I would get the games completely done and then hand them off to an art director, and I would go work on another game and the art director would go do the artwork. But since it's part-time and I'm not making a living, my full living off of it, it's a little messier, I would say. And so we often make a lot of changes, probably more than, well, I guess I don't really know what professionals do, but I feel like it's a constant back and forth and iterating on everything where, you know, you see a piece of art and you're like, oh, that could go here. And the mechanics then start to evolve a little bit. I think, I don't know if it's because I'm an indie creator, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of moving pieces in there and trying to, you know, there's always this moment in every game for me where we're trying to tie it all together. And it's like, this just isn't working. This card back isn't really giving off the right vibe, or you can't see this text across the table. Maybe we need the cards to be bigger. There's just sort of always this moment when it all comes together that we got to change something. And it's probably just because it's not a waterfall process. And I don't know if creative work ever really can be. I'm sure, you know, people thinking about comics, it's probably a similar thing. You start sketching, and then when you get to text and coloring, there's just changes that always have to be made as you iterate on these works. I think we had the mechanics pretty solid on The Fox in the Forest. We knew that it was cards with numbers, and there was a place for where text would go. Some of the texts changed over time, even after we had some of the artwork done. We did have one piece of artwork. I guess this is worth mentioning. We had one piece of artwork that we did, and it's an element in the story that at the end of playtesting, we just realized it was too confusing for players, and so we scrapped it. We were going to have an extra card. And we have this beautiful artwork, and it's an element of the story. It's the mirror. We ended up having to take it out. All the other cards that had special abilities, they weren't active until you played them. But with the mirror, it was supposed to be mirroring the trump card at all times. And so when you're holding it in your hand, it's as if you have that card in your hand. But people would get confused about that. They would think that it would not become that card until they played it. And so they would not follow suit with it, even though they had to. So you would lead and they would slough off suit. So you'd be like, oh, well, they're out of that suit. You play again, and then they'd play the mirror, and you're like, wait, you had to play that last turn. And so we did have to scrap that, and it was kind of sad. The artwork is amazing on that one, and it's a great – Alana wove it into the story very well.
oh, definitely.
I'm hoping we can put it out as a promo card or in an expansion of some kind where we can make a bigger deal about the fact that it's different. That was a late decision. I'm still sad about the beautiful artwork.
I'm someone who is huge into music, but I'm not a musician. And so I always think of music as like magic and how all the different elements of the song coming together. And even in my own writing, I tend to think of things musically, of like writing a song and the different elements of the song that have to come together and the different instruments that sort of make it happen. And so I do think like exactly what you're saying about how the one piece of the process starts to inform the other, even if you thought that first piece was all set. It's like as the song progresses and the music comes together, you start to hear things a little bit differently and you start to hear things work together. And I feel like any creative process has elements of that sort of until that magic moment where the song just sort of all gels, you know, and feels like it's right. So
yeah, as a business, as someone making a product, it would be easier if it wasn't like that. But as a creative, it's definitely those fun moments where you finally get it all tied together and there are things that you wouldn't have seen. You couldn't have even imagined these mechanics until you got, you know, started getting the artwork coming in. So,
well, I mean, just from what I've seen so far and what I've, you know, read about the game, it certainly feels like that stuff has all come together. And so July 19th, again, is when the game is coming out. I will put links to the website as well as the places where people can read the rules and also even see the video review that's already gone up about the game. So I hope you have a fantastic launch. It was really great to talk to both of you tonight and just sort of hear about how this project came together. So I wish you a great launch, and Alana, I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Sure. I love to come back.
And Randy, I'd love to talk to you about your next project as well.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on. It's just great to share the love of board games and card games with people outside of the space. So, I hope a few people will discover it and maybe discover a whole new world of hobby board games.
I certainly think that we will have that, and I will point them in your direction for the other games as well, because I definitely want to check out the World's Fair game. So.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, you guys take care.
Thanks, Brian.
The greatest superheroes come to the Mohegan Sun August 18th to the 20th. Terrificon, Connecticut's number one Comic-Con, returns. Meet actors from the Game of Thrones, Flash, Guardians of the Galaxy, Stranger Things, and a special tribute to TV's Batman Adam West on Saturday night. 300 exhibitors, including top artists from Marvel and DC. See the Batmobile, the Batboat, even the Batcopter. It's Terrificon, Connecticut's terrific Comic-Con, Mohegan Sun, August 18th to the 20th. Tickets at Mohegan Sun Box Office or Ticketmaster.com. See more at Terrificon.com.